Hi, I'm Eric Bazillion, and you are listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today, he's in another country. You know him as one of the founding members and lead singers of the band Hooters. He has an amazing new solo album coming out, simply called Bazillion. Please welcome Eric Bazillion. Hello, Eric. How are you doing?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm good. So first things first, you have a new album. It's not yet released, correct?
Right. Couple of weeks, I think. Yep.
And it's simply titled Bazillion.
Yep. I couldn't think of anything better. And then I actually, it's funny, when Paul McCartney's most recent came out called McCartney 3, I realized that was because there was a McCartney 2 and there was a McCartney, and it's been sitting there in plain sight. I'd never used Bazillion, and it looked kind of good on the photo that I had chosen. So I thought, why not? I only get one chance to call it Bazillion. And if not now, when?
That's right. And then if you follow McCartney, in 20 years, we'll get Bazillion 2. And in 40 years, we'll get Bazillion 3.
That's yes. And then even Bazillion 4.
Hopefully. So let's talk about the new record. It's a solid 10 songs, 35 minutes. I love it. I mean, top to bottom, you know, because sometimes you don't know. You listen to an album for the first time and you're wondering, which one am I going to fast forward? And this one is solid top to bottom. So congratulations. It's
thanks.
Excellent. I really, really like it. If I didn't, I would just do what David Letterman used to do. He would tell the people, now I haven't yet seen the film.
Right.
But this is great. And it's been about 9 years since you've released any new music?
Since I've released a solo album, it's 20 years.
Yes, but Bazillion and Wester came out in 2012.
That came out in 2012. I've released a few singles since then. Mm-hmm. Some of them solo, some of them collaborations. This is the first in a long time.
But proper solo album, you're right, 20 years.
20, yep.
Okay, so let's talk about the album a little bit. First of all, tell people, I said we're 9 hour time difference away. Where are you right now?
I'm in Stockholm, Sweden.
And can I ask what you're doing in Sweden?
My family and I have been headquartered here since 2017.
Oh, wow.
Pretty much. Until COVID, I was commuting a lot. My wife is Swedish. She's been a good sport and put 20 some years into living full time in Pennsylvania. And we decided it was time just for a fun change. So it was originally going to be 1 year, then it became two, then COVID, and we're still here. We were actually just back in the States. We got back yesterday.
Okay.
In fact, I was back in January and February, got vaccinated then. I brought my family back there to get vaccinated because it's slow going here.
Yeah. Good idea.
Yep. But so we've been, you know, pretty much headquartered here, and I got very lucky, and there was a room in the basement in the building we're living in, an apartment building, and I was able to set up a little satellite provisional studio and started writing songs and recording them, and it turned into an album.
And so did you play all the instruments on the album?
I played all the instruments except for the drums.
Okay.
The drums were played by David Wasikinen from the Hooters.
Okay.
He recorded them himself in his house in Philadelphia, or a guy named Roman Rate in Slovenia.
It's amazing how you can make a record now as opposed to back in the 80s. They can record their parts and email them to you, or however they get them to you. And then you just layer it all in. It's kind of like a magic trick.
It really is. It's crazy. And I've been doing that for a long time. I mean, I was an early adopter with digital recording, with the internet. So I've been doing that, but now it's really become sort of the way you do things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the norm.
And it works though. You know, it's not like being in the room, you know, when certainly not like being in a room and playing together with right. a band at the same time. But even if you're overdubbing a drummer, you know, to be in the control room and go, yeah, or maybe.
Right.
But you know, this worked and, you know, I got some great performances out of them. You know, there are various and sundry other guest spots. William Whitman, the legendary producer engineer, he played bass on Absolutely. Heaven Ain't Gonna Save Us. And then John Fields, who was another great producer, he mixed the High Note, the opening track. And while he was at it, he played some keyboards. And I thought, yeah, great.
There you go. It's harder to give people notes when they just send the track to you, though, right? Because yeah. then you have to send it back to them.
Right. But often what happens is they'll send different takes. They'll send different okay. options, which, you know, is a whole can of worms. Because, you know, a 4-minute song, you can sit there for 4 hours going through, you know, do I like that fill? Do I like this fill? What about that kick drum there?
When did you start recording this album? When did you decide, I think I'm going to make an album? Was it during lockdown?
It was during, well, it's a funny story about how it actually turned into an album. I'd started doing songs here 2018, 19, just, mm-hmm. it wasn't lockdown, but in a way it's been sort of an exile for me.
Okay.
It's self-imposed. You know, I felt like I had grown a bit too comfortable back home in Pennsylvania. You know, I've got an awesome studio in my carriage house. And I just thought it would be good for a change. And it felt a bit like exile, even though I speak the language fluently and I'm very at home here.
Okay.
But I started writing songs kind of themed around that. And then I did the cover of Help just at the beginning of COVID before we knew really what that was going to imply regarding our lives and how long it would be. And then I had just finished that and I did a podcast and I didn't know what the podcast was going in because I like to be surprised. And
wait,
you
did your own podcast. You were hosting.
No. I was a guest on.
You were guest on another podcast. Yeah. Okay.
Another podcast. Sorry. You're not the first.
Okay. Well, it's hard to be first in podcasting.
Yeah. But it was with a woman she's a medium, and her MO is she gets a guest on and you pick someone who's gone to the other side that you want to communicate with. So okay. I said, my father who passed away in 2017 and, you know, asked him, where's my grandmother's birth certificate? And she said, oh, he's laughing. That's a trick question. Hmm. Oh, but he's saying that there's a song that you have been working on that you're ready to give up on and you should finish it and you should release an EP.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that's something my dad would say. Mm-hmm. And so first I was going to do an EP and then I realized, you know what, let's, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, let's do an album.
Right.
And the song that he was referring to is Back in the 80s.
Back in we had big hair, you had a fast car and places to go. There was Bon Jovi living on a prayer, and we had the Thompson twins to hold us now. Those were the days, my
which is the single that I'm releasing this Friday. And I had started the song and sort of hit a dead end with it. I didn't know where to go. And after I got that message, I went downstairs and wrote the chorus.
And did it come quickly after you got that message? Did it just kind of come out of you?
It just came out. I sat down, I listened to the track, put the headphones on, got to a blank spot in the music and started singing. And that's what came out. That's how I write. That is my writing process.
So the medium, this woman, she knew who you were. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be difficult to maybe say, hey, you're working on a song. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But even if you're cynical and you don't believe in those things, it still worked because you went and you finished that song.
Yep. Absolutely. I neither believe nor disbelieve in anything.
Right. And that's probably a good way to be.
It works for me.
Yeah. So first of all, you talked about two songs. The cover of Help, you really made it your own. Because even when it starts, it doesn't start like Help does exactly, right. You know, with that, whatever you want to call it, a power chord or whatever you want to. And it really takes you a second to realize that it's the Beatles' Help. At least it did for me. Like, I'm like, oh, this sounds for, I'm like, oh, this, okay. So great job, because I really like your version.
When I was younger, so much younger than
Because with covers, you either make it your own or you do an exact duplicate of it with your own voice. And I liked what you did. So fantastic.
Well, it's funny how that happened, because I didn't set out to cover that song.
Okay.
I came up with a mandola riff and the guitar riff, and I made a musical track and started singing to it, which is how I write songs. I make something that sounds like a record, and then I find something to sing. And I started singing Help. And then I realized, well, I'm not going to write a better song than this. And I have sort of made it my own. And it was really astonishing how hand in glove the Help melody and lyrics went with the musical track. So I rode with it. And there it is.
It's kind of COVID and pandemic related a little bit too, because we all kind of need some help.
Yeah, well, that was the thought, and even the artwork for that. I don't know if you've seen the artwork.
Yeah, it's isn't it the American Sign Language?
Yeah, but yeah. With surgical gloves.
With surgical gloves, yes, that's the
rather than semaphore like the Beatles had done it.
Yeah, but it's very cool. I really like that cover. And then you just talked about Back in the 80s, which has tons of name checking and name dropping, and then even that song then ends with COVID-y lockdown lyrics. And I really, this album is, there's a lot, you talk a lot about what's the pandemic.
Yeah. But again, a lot of it was a feeling that I had already started diving into, just the feeling of being away from home, of, you know, everything is different now.
Yes.
So the pandemic was just sort of the punctuation on a sentence that had started several years earlier.
Yeah, the songs definitely, they definitely stand on their own. It's not like something I'm going to listen to in 3 years and think, oh, about the pandemic. The lyrics touch on things that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah,
and they'll touch on things that we are dealing with in the future and in the past. So I love it. And
thanks.
That Back in the 80s, it's just a great song. You reference Bon Jovi and the Thompson Twins and obviously the Beatles. And then there's a line, something about, are the good times gone? Do you feel, do you feel like the good times are gone?
It feels that way sometimes. I mean, that's, I think that's a feeling that everyone has a lot of the time. There's always that feeling, you know, everything used to be better. Every, you know, oh, back in the 80s, man, that was the time, or the 60s, that was the time. And you know what? Someday we'll look back on this and we'll go, that was a time. I think it's really, you know, again, I sort of channel these things and I spend the rest of my life trying to figure out what I meant. You know, the chorus keeps changing, you know, for the, you know, the first chorus is, where are they now? Why do the good times fade away? Why can't we just hold on to all the things we loved back in the day? And then it becomes, where are we now? Why do the good times fade away? Why can't we just hold on to all the things we love for one more day? And then at the end, why can't we just hold on to all the friends we love and never let them fade away? So it's really about holding on to the moment, I think.
More
than it is about looking back. It's just like, yeah, you can say this was great, that's great, but now is what we've got.
And where do you live as a person? Do you live, like for me, I'm always in today. I really don't look back. And I don't like to look too far ahead. I just kind of live right now. Like today, what am I doing? I'm interviewing Eric today. This is what my day is. And then I'm going to take my daughter to get her second vaccine. But this is my day. But so what about you? How do you live your life?
It depends. You know, it depends on what phase I'm in. You know, there are times when I'm in a project where I'm completely in the moment. This is what I'm doing today. What am I having for lunch? Being on tour, you know, being on tour is a totally immersive experience. You know, now it's been a bit different because there hasn't been so much definition, you know, it's been kind of an open slate, but, I have my routines now. I've been learning to play Bach violin sonatas on the mandolin for the past 3 years. And, you know, that's a regimen, a couple of hours a day of that.
I would say so. Yes. How many instruments do you play?
Well, I play guitar well. I play bass well. I play mandolin pretty well. I play any stringed instrument varying degrees of well.
Okay.
I know my way around a keyboard. Me and Pro Tools make a good drummer. And I have interesting stylings on the saxophone.
All right. That's a lot. That's it.
I mean, and I can play harmonica and recorder. I mean, I can play just about anything you put in my hands or in my mouth.
And has this always been the case with you? Like as a kid, when did you first pick up your first instrument?
I picked up guitar, well, piano when I was 5 or 6. My mother was a virtuoso concert pianist. And I was inspired by that. And I took lessons for a while. And then I got frustrated with that because the teacher wouldn't let me jump ahead and do fun things.
Right.
Then I picked up guitar when I was 9. So I already had enough skill when the Beatles played on Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those kids who said, I'm going to form a band. Well, I was actually able to form a band the next day because I could play guitar.
That's amazing.
Me and Steve Lukather, we have that. Well, we have a lot in common. But
Steve's been on the show twice. Actually, really, a couple of people that you've worked with in the past have been on the show. Patti Smyth. Who I love. And then just like a couple of weeks ago, Klaus Meine of Scorpions was on.
Oh, cool. I love Klaus.
So it was another record where there was a 9-hour difference. I'm jumping ahead now, but we're going to get back to the new record. Mm-hmm. Eric Bazilian and Scorpions isn't something that I would ever think in my head I would put together. How did that come about for you to write songs with Klaus and the Scorpions?
They contacted me out of the blue. I think they have the same management in the US that Zucchero has. And I had written some English lyrics for Zucchero a few years ago. And I don't know how that happened either, but all I know is suddenly I was in Capri with Zucchero. But the Scorpions contacted me and I went over, didn't know what to expect. And it was great from the beginning. I connected with those guys, you know, right away. You know, Klaus was an amazing singer and lyricist, with great instincts. Rudolph is a total gas to be around. His energy is insane. He's a great guitar player. And then, you know, and I got to know what's his name? The other guitar player.
Mateus.
Mateus, who is amazing. And I'm hell on guitarists when I'm producing, but he just totally blew me away. Every time I had a suggestion, he'd just knock it out of the park.
Humanity, auf Wiedersehen, it's time to say goodbye. The party's over as the laughter dies. An angel cries, humanity, it's au revoir to your insanity. You sold to feed your vanity, your fantasies and lies. You're a drop in the rain, just a number, not a name, and you don't see it, you don't believe it. At the end of the day, you're a needle in the hay.
And what's it like when you just meet someone and now you're going to start to write a songs together? Like if it's someone that you've known all your life, you have a give and take and you're probably able to say, I don't like that, or let's try this. But with someone brand new, how do you get that songwriting bond going to where you feel comfortable to tell them that you don't like something they brought to the table and vice versa?
You know, I've never had a situation where it was awkward.
Okay.
Well, maybe one or two. But, you know, generally, if someone wants to write with you, it's because they want to hear what you've got to offer. Yeah. You know, if they didn't want to hear what I had to say, I wouldn't be in the room.
That's true. Okay, that makes sense.
And, you know, likewise, on one hand, it's my job to say, I don't think that's good. But on the other hand, if I'm writing with someone for that artist, it's my job to see, okay, what is them? Who are they? And is what they're bringing to the table reflective of their best self as an artist.
And when you write with Scorpions, though, do you have to put on like your heavy metal hat, which is a hat that maybe you never wore before, or at least we've never heard it throughout your career?
Right, right. Well, I have worn that hat many times. I wore that hat really for the first 15 years of my career.
Okay.
I mean, until the Hooters happened, which was a conscious decision to leave behind the shredding metally blues rock thing that I was doing, and Rob as well, who was, you know, he's a virtuoso keyboard player. But when we decided we're going to do something that's fun and people can dance to, and in the beginning that was pretty much ska and reggae, we're going to set those tools aside for now. But I started my life as a shredder guitar player, worshiping at the altar of Hendrix, Beck and Clapton.
Okay, so then for you, this was kind of a new dream come true. You get to go back and work with some heavyweights in this genre, and they want to work with you. So that's cool.
Yeah.
I want to just give a quick rundown of so many people you've written songs with. Robbie Williams, Ricky Martin, songs for Ronnie Spector, Leanne Rimes. Do you think you're more successful as a songwriter now? What do you consider yourself? Do you consider yourself a singer, a songwriter? What brings you the most pride or joy?
I'm a musician.
Okay.
I make music. Whatever needs to be done to make music, I will do to the best of my ability.
Okay.
I have the most fun doing actually everything. I love being in the studio and playing guitar. I love figuring out a bass part. I love writing a song. I love having a lyric come to me fully fleshed out from wherever they come from. I love sitting in a room with other people. I love sitting in a room by myself. I love getting out on stage and performing. That's probably the biggest rush there is.
All right. So basically you are living your dream.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see your eyes kind of light up as you just saying the word music, your eyes are lighting up. So, all right, let's jump back to this brand new album. I want to find out some more things. You already told me who plays on it. I always feel like the opening track is very key. And this this one kicks off with a song that I love called The High Note. how much time goes into the sequencing of an album? Because for me, obviously writing and recording is one thing, but then once you have all these songs, now they have to flow perfectly, you know, for the listener to be engaged. How much time do you put into the sequencing?
I try to let it happen organically. Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, it's funny, you know, to a certain extent, it's sort of chronological. Mm-hmm. I think the High Note, well, Help was the first track.
Right.
But the High Note was the first song that I wrote during this whole cycle. Although then I added some songs that were earlier, like Where Home Is, I wrote, you know, about a year into exile and trying to figure out, in fact, where home is. Bleed Red, which is the last song on the album, I actually wrote, I think, in 2018. You know, with the Hooters, you know, to sequence an album, we would sit there for hours and listen through. I don't have the patience for that. So right. I would just sort of make a random sequence, put it on and go, nah, that doesn't work. And I just keep tweaking it and leave it for a couple of days and come back and, yeah, this works. You know, I don't even know that I came up with the ultimate sequence. But my friend Martin in Slovenia, my brilliant producer friend who mastered this record for me and really gave me a lot of great advice, he said, this song must end the album.
And so it does.
And so it does.
Black boy getting shot, any corner, any town. White girl turning tricks, $20. Which so many shades, so many colors these days, who cares which one is which? Cause all men bleed red. Living together on this blue-green planet, circling around this yellow sun.
I mean, the thing is, you know, the thing about sequencing, it's funny. Think about the Beatles albums. Like in the U.S., we got completely different sequences.
Absolutely.
And to me, those are still the sequences. It still freaks me out when I listen to the British versions, which I've been listening to for way longer than I listen to the American ones.
Yeah.
So I don't know how crucial sequencing really is. I mean, even Sgt. Pepper had an alternate sequence.
I did not know that.
Yep. And then the way people listen nowadays, who listens to albums?
Well, I still do, Eric.
Good. So do I, which is why I did an album.
Yeah. Whenever you record an album, do you feel like, do you always feel like this most recent work is your best work?
Sure. Which is why you really need to like take a pause at some point, because that isn't always the case.
Right. Yeah. True. And time will let you know that.
Yep. And it's funny with sequencing this album, I had a bunch more songs that I was considering for it. And I just, you know, and I tried them in different places and it just felt like, no, this is the album. I know it's 10 songs. It's 35 minutes. It'll be perfect on vinyl.
Yeah.
I won't have to keep anything off on vinyl.
No, you won't. And then you have songs left over for Bazillion 2.
Yeah, right. In 20 years.
It is, you know, sometimes just because you can fill a CD with 16 or 17 songs doesn't mean that you should.
Right.
And again, like I said, these 10 tracks, when it's over, you want to hit play again.
Great.
You know, I don't need four more tracks when I can just listen to these 10 again. These are, right. this is what I need. This is what I want. So again, I really do want people to go out and seek out this album when it's released. Do you have an exact release date yet?
May 14th, I believe.
May 14th. Perfect. So it'll just be a couple weeks after this drops.
Which means I better get it in the portal right now. I keep forgetting about that.
And so CD, it's, and obviously vinyl, because you just teased that.
Haven't done the vinyl yet. That's going to take a while.
Okay.
CDs, I made up, my radio promo guy told me I had to make some up because radio, even though they never listen to CDs, they won't consider adding you unless they have a physical thing. But when I get back to the U.S., I'm going to make up a bunch and I will commercially distribute them.
Okay, so it's initially just going to be released as digitally.
Digitally, yep.
So physical product will be coming down the road.
Yep.
All right, cool. That was the great thing about COVID. I know a lot of, odd. A lot of my favorite artists, some people held albums back, but then people like Soul Asylum and the Pretenders, they didn't. And right. I appreciated that because you don't have to leave your house to get music anymore.
Right.
And I needed that. I needed their music, you know, to help get me through some days. So, you know, I still love physical stuff, but digital is the way to go for instant gratification.
Yeah. At this point, absolutely. And as far as physical goes, I mean, who has a CD player?
I mean, your laptop now doesn't even have a disc drive.
Right.
And right. If you buy a new car, it doesn't have a CD player in it.
Right.
I have a 2016 that I don't want to get rid of because it's still got my CD player in it.
Yep.
So it is weird when if they're making something that you almost can't play anywhere unless you have an old component system or a boombox. Who knows?
And then, you know, vinyl is awesome because it's big and it's, you know, it's fun. And some people do. I think more people probably have turntables now than they have CD drives.
Well, because you can buy turntables now, too.
Right.
I mean, it's easily accessible. And I'm sure CDs are probably going to come back in 5 years. Who knows?
Yeah.
Everything keeps coming back. Let's talk about the career. Six studio albums with the Hooters, an EP with Hooters. Is it the Hooters or is it Hooters?
It's the Hooters. Even before we had the on the name, it was the Hooters. It was an invisible the.
It was an invisible the. Okay. And of course, you have three solo albums.
Yep.
And the solo albums, what's great is your new one came out. And then I went back and revisited the other ones. And The Optimist is fantastic.
Thanks. Yeah, still that's...
a great album.
I feel like that's sort of the one that got away.
Yeah.
You know, but I know I love that record. That is kind of me in a nutshell. Oh, how did I get in this nutshell? But then again, all three of them are.
Yeah.
You know, A Very Dull Boy is where I was a year later. It's funny, that album I wrote and recorded in 6 days in my in-law's barn in Sweden.
And that has that does have a more raw feel to it. You know what I mean? And that's not to, belittle it. It's not as produced as The Optimist was.
Sure. That was intentional. This one's somewhere in between.
Yeah. This has a DIY feel to it, but it sounds great. It really, and again, I don't know, it's hard to express, how this music makes me feel, but it's really upbeat and it's positive. And, it's just a real feel good album. Like I think if people get this, this is going to be one of the albums that they play all summer long.
I hope so, man.
It just feels like,
thank you.
You know, roll the windows down and turn up the car stereo, you know, when you're, you know, driving along the beach. It just feels great. The Optimist, you said you feel like it's the one that got away. And that's what's great, because if people are listening to this show right now, they can head over to iTunes and then it won't be the one that got away. They can rediscover it. I want to ask about a couple songs on The Optimist. The song Ugly.
One night she's a flame on a candle. One night she's a hand on a hip. One night she's a wave and a smile. And one night she's a Freudian slip. One night she's a knock on the front door. Red wine and a beanbag chair. One night she's a girl of your dreams. The next night she ain't there. And then it gets ugly. Ugly. How can love let us down so many times? Such a beautiful goodbye, but you just feel UGLY, and that's ugly.
Now, this is a different version than the version that I know from Jon Bon Jovi's solo album, Destination Anywhere. So, which version came first? And did you guys write this song together?
I wrote the version that Jon Bon Jovi does. I wrote by myself while my wife was pregnant with our son.
Okay.
And it was sort of for her because, you know, she was a beautiful woman who was pregnant and felt the way women feel when they're pregnant sometimes, right, which is not hot. And I wrote the song just to make her feel good. And then I had been writing with John already. Me and John and Desmond Child had gotten together and written a bunch of songs. So John came to see me do a songwriter show at the Bottom Line in New York. And he called me the next day and said, I love that song. I think, you know, with some work, it could be great for my solo album.
Excellent.
So, you know, changed a couple of lines around and.
And I wish I was a camera sometimes, so I could take your picture with my mind. Put it in a frame for you to see how beautiful you really are to me. Ugly, ugly. All of us just be like that someday.
And it had always been my intention to release my original demo of the song on my solo album. And I pulled up the tracks and, you know, just to tweak it and make sure it sounded right. And I just kind of felt like that version of the song was out already.
Right.
And I just started messing around with it and it turned into what it became, which is a completely different story.
It is. Yes, you know, it definitely is. When I was listening to it, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this is totally different. But both versions, great.
Thanks. Yeah, they're both, you know, they're separate but equal.
Speaking of songs that got away or something that got away, you and John wrote a song that I guess for the Crush album, but it didn't make it on the Crush album. It was released as a B-side. Sad Song Night is just, yeah. It's one of my favorite Bon Jovi songs. I love that song so much. And so many, no one knows that song really.
She told me I'm dancing. Spanish town. She got a kick out of watching me spin around and round. Stars shone bright and moon hung low. Willie DeVille was singing on the radio. Well, it's a sad song night. Well, a long ago girl running through my mind. It's a sad song night. Ain't nothing stopping.
I know that is really one that got away. I remember writing that very clearly. We were in a hotel room in Dublin. Desmond and John and I had decided to meet there to write. And that was the first song we wrote. And it really felt like a thing. And I don't know why it didn't go on the album.
I mean, I don't know why either. I mean, I love the Crush album. I don't know what I would replace, you know, I don't know what I would put a Sad Song Night in, what song I would remove, but it's just such a good song. It's such a great song. And the thing about the podcast, Eric, is when this drops, I will, like if we talk about a song, I'll edit in a piece of the song. So people, you're getting to hear that right now. All right. Of course, we can't talk to you without talking about the Hooters. So we're going to go,
of course not.
Going to go all the way back. 1983, you have your independent release, Amore. Now, when this came out, was this the first album, professionally recorded album that you had been a part of?
Oh, no, no, not at all. I mean, I did my first, well, Baby Grand, the band that Rob and I had before the Hooters. We had two albums on Arista.
Wow.
77 and 78. Yep.
See, I didn't know about Baby Grand, and I thought I did.
Okay.
I thought I did all my homework. I thought I knew all my stuff.
No, Baby Grand was. So I met Rob in 1971. That'll be 50 years in September.
So how old are you two guys when you meet?
I was 18.
Okay.
I was a freshman in college. He was a senior, and he had a band that didn't have a guitar player. I didn't have a band. I was a guitar player, joined his band.
That's how it works.
He and the singer graduated, and Rick Chertoff, who was the drummer, Rick decided he was going to become a producer. Got a gig for Clive Davis, found Mandy for Barry Manilow, became an A&R hero for Clive. David, the singer, and Rob continued writing songs, and they got signed as Baby Grand, right as I was getting ready to graduate, and they needed a guitar player. So they brought me into the fold, and we made two albums, which are great albums. They were either 10 years ahead of their time or 10 years behind, but at a time when punk and minimalistic things like the Talking Heads were happening, we're trying to get paid by the note. we're doing Steely Dan on steroids.
Are those albums available in digital outlets?
Those are not. Those are not. In fact, we've been trying to rectify that. I do keep them in my Dropbox, though. If anyone's ever anyone wants to DM me, I'll gladly send that link.
Consider this a DM.
Okay, you got it. I think they're on YouTube. Actually, I think so. People have ripped them onto YouTube.
Gotcha.
So we had done those, and then we did, we actually released the Hooters released our first single in 81. If you can. And then we did one in 82. And then we took a break from the band in 82 to do the Cyndi Lauper album. So we had done a fair amount of professional recording when we went in to do Amore by ourselves and you know, and produce that ourselves.
And what was it like working on She's So Unusual? Because she's basically a new artist at that time too. She was with Blue Angel, but this is kind of, this is her solo debut. And I mean, when you look back, you just think that Cyndi Lauper has always been a thing, but you guys are working, you guys are at ground zero on Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Ground zero. In many ways, it was ground zero. It was never a dull moment working with Cyndi. You know, Rick Chertoff got the gig producing her, and he decided that rather than using studio musicians, he wanted to put together a real arranging playing team. So he brought her to Rob and I, and we spent 6 months at our rehearsal space in Philadelphia with my four-track Porta Studio cassette recorder and my 808 drum machine, and we started demoing songs. Rick had brought in Girls Just Want to Have Fun and Money Changes Everything, and All Through the Night, which is what Rick is genius at, and which really comes into play in the story of One of Us and how that happened. But
and of course, that's the Joan Osborne song. We'll get to it.
Yep. Well, oh yeah, we'll get to that. We spent 6 months doing, you know, demos of the song. You know, Girls Just Want to Have Fun was a real odyssey because she hated the song from the beginning. She kept saying, "I will never sing that song. I will never sing that song." And then one day we were talking about Come On Eileen, because this was 1982, and who didn't love Come On Eileen?
Right, exactly.
And then in the middle of the conversation, Rick comes up and says, "Well, what about Girls Just Want to Have Fun?" And Cyndi said, "Well, can you make it sound like Come On Eileen?" And I thought, and I said, "You know what? I can." So I changed the drum beat on the 808 to do what Come On Eileen does. Boom, ba-dum, boom, ba-dum. I picked up my guitar and I played da 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 da. She started singing, and the rest is, as they say, history. That really was just a great example of teamwork, you know, of having the right brains and being in the right place at the right time. You know, if Rick had not been relentless with getting her to sing that song, if Come On Eileen hadn't inspired us, if I hadn't picked up the guitar at that moment, you know, if Rob hadn't come up with his chordal thing, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
And did this lead then to Columbia signing the Hooters because of your work on this album?
You would think. to some degree it did, you know, at this point. So, you know, after She's So Unusual came out, we did Amore, and we sold 150,000 copies of that in our region, you know, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, which was unheard of. We were selling out the Tower Theater. We were like the Beatles in the tri-state area. We could not get arrested.
But at that point, do you still feel like you've made it when you're doing all these things?
You know, it felt like we're making it.
You were making it. Okay, that's a good way to put it. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, where's the next step? You know, fortunately, we had Rick Chertoff in our back pocket, and he was working for Columbia at this point. And I think he might have had to twist an arm or two to get us signed. You know, we were from Philadelphia. That was a curse back then.
And you know, why was that a curse?
Because we were too close to New York.
Okay.
Or not close enough.
Mm.
You know, at that point, you know, A&R people would gladly fly to Athens, Georgia, or to Iowa to see a band. But Philadelphia, it's like, nah, you come here. Which means that either they can come see us play in a venue in Philadelphia with 2,000 people going crazy, or we can go play at a showcase in New York for 30 people.
Yeah.
Which happened a couple of times. We finally, you know, finally Rick got someone from Columbia to come to Philadelphia and see us and see what the magic was. And, you know, finally we got signed to Columbia.
Now, Eric, I would tell you, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, right outside State College, PA.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hooters didn't make it to me until I got to college, and guys from Philly, they all had the album.
Yep.
And I'd be like, what's this? Then they'd be angry. They'd be get angry if you didn't know it. This is our band. This is from where we live. So
Philly strong.
Yeah, exactly. So then you get signed to Columbia and Nervous Night comes out. And now do you feel like you've made it? Or you still feel like you're making it?
You know, I think it's probably a fairly common experience that artists, bands, when they're at that phase in their lives, they're so overwhelmed that you don't notice.
Okay.
You know, yeah. I mean, when I got my first gold record, did I feel like I'd made it? I suppose so.
Mm-hmm.
When I started seeing And We Danced on MTV, like every hour. Yeah, that kind of felt like we've made it.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm on South Street in Philadelphia at 2 o'clock in the morning and a convertible full of girls blasting, Don't Take My Car Out Tonight, come driving along. That kind of felt like, yeah.
Okay. Those are all cool things.
Yeah, they're very, but you know what? There were a lot of cool things before I made it.
All right.
And on some level, I feel like I'm still trying to make it.
When CDs came out, there's a bonus track on Nervous Night, and it's the title track.
And me, maybe we can make it through this emergency. Yeah. Oh, Mother State, African queen, we said so many things we didn't mean. There'll be another day, maybe it'd be alright.
Whose bright idea was it to leave the title track off of the vinyl release? Because I love that song so much.
We went back and forth on that a lot.
Okay.
If we had included it, it would have made one side of the album too long to get the maximum volume.
Okay.
That was like a big thing. It probably still is. I think 18 minutes and something is the max you can get on one side and really get competitively loud.
Okay.
So, and I guess on some level, we knew that we would eventually sell more CDs than we would albums anyway.
At that point in time, when CDs were starting to become the big deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some marketing genius probably thought, oh, people will buy both.
Yeah. And I did. And I bought both.
And a lot of people did. I bought both for a lot of things.
It worked. Yeah. It's just odd to me that the song that, it always seemed odd to me that the song that was the bonus track is the title track. But
I know.
Who knows?
And we tried, you know, we did try other sequences, including that in the 8 songs, but that's just the way it happened.
The way it goes.
And it's a good subject for conversation.
Because even on the CD, it's not tacked on at the end. I believe it's track 5 on the CD.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah. I'm going to ask this question again. You're probably going to punch me, but July 13th, 1985, at 9:10 a.m. at JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, PA, at that point, did you feel you had made it?
Yeah, I think it felt like we were really making it.
Okay.
At that point. I felt like, boy, if we don't make it now, something's really wrong.
Chevy Chase, Joe Piscopo. This next group appears courtesy of the Westwood One Radio Network. This is their hometown. Give them a big welcome, Philadelphia's own, the Hooters! One, two, three,
I mean, that's an incredible thing to be a part of, Live Aid, yeah, sure, in your hometown.
Yeah, I mean, it was just amazing how all the pieces fell together on that. You know, we were on tour already with Don Henley, and there was a break in the tour. I think we missed one show to go back and do Live Aid. But, and you know, just the fact that All You Zombies had been out for a while and had made a bit of noise. And We Danced was about to come out. We were just about to shoot the video for that. And being the hometown band, being the ones who were able to say, welcome to Philadelphia.
That's amazing. Did you have to get Don Henley's permission to miss that show?
I think he gave it. I don't even think he noticed at that point.
Live Aid is such an incredible thing. I've told the story on this show before. I was on vacation with my family in Ocean City, Maryland. And, you know, there's no VCR or anything, you know, there's no, you know, DVR, none of that. So if you weren't watching it, you missed it. And yeah. I kept going up to the condo where we were staying on vacation and watching it. And my dad kept coming up and he was so mad that I wasn't out on the beach with the family and he didn't understand, Dad, this is once in a lifetime. If I miss this, yep, I'm missing it. And Led, yep, Zeppelin's going to play. And I can't miss this. So sometimes dads don't get it. I assume you're a dad that does get it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How many kids?
Oh, yeah. Three.
Girls, boys, ages?
Girl, 32. Boy, 24. Girl, 20.
Wow. My oldest is 20 and youngest is 16. Any grandkids yet?
Nope. I hope so. I hope so. My oldest is getting married this summer. Not that that has anything to do with it, but
sure. Yeah, you can have kids no matter what.
Yes, you can. Yeah. It's very funny because in Sweden, very few people get married.
Okay.
I mean, most couples are, and very few will take the other's name. Although it's fairly common here that a couple will get married and they will take on a new name.
Oh, that's interesting. That's kind of cool.
Kind of cool.
Were the kids raised in Sweden?
My two younger ones, whose mother I'm married to now, have spent every summer of their lives here. Mm-hmm. We spoke both languages at home, come here every other Christmas, spent a couple of full years here before. So they, I think they both identify as binational.
All right. That's a gift just to be able to speak two languages, being raised with two languages.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And my oldest, you know, didn't grow up here, mm-hmm, or grow up with Swedish in the house all the time, but she understands the language and I think she feels a pull.
Very nice.
To the other home country.
Now, are any of these kids involved in the music industry? Was it handed down?
My son is very, very much all in. As an artist, as a singer, songwriter, guitarist, and he's working his ass off at it.
And you know the struggles of making it in the music business. And you also know that that's even more difficult sometimes today.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fight and you don't know who the opponent is.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like the ring is dark and they're just sending in gladiators and you don't know where to look. Look, it's really tough. There used to be a path.
Yeah. You know, a system.
You had a band, you played live, you put up flyers, you maybe released an independent record, you got signed, you got a booking agent, you got a manager. Now, you know, it's the Wild West.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, you know, your son can put his music up on YouTube and get, you know, millions of hits. But as far as making a living and making a career in music, it's a totally different thing. But now, since you went through this, are you supportive of his decision to embrace music as a career? Or do you put on your dad hat and you're like, maybe you should do this?
I am totally supportive, as was my father to me. And without his support, I don't know that I could have done it. So I'm passing that on.
Okay, good. Good for you. I'm sure he appreciates that big time.
I think he does. I think he does. It's been great watching him evolve, and he's really, he's found his guy. You know, every artist they've got a guy.
Yeah.
Gender non-specific guy. Mm-hmm. And he's really found his, and you know, now the challenge is
how to get it out there. Exactly. Look, my parents are still mad at me because I moved to California. So I'm glad that you're embracing your son's career choices. So 2 million copies of Nervous Night, which is no small feat, because in 1985, you're competing with Prince and Springsteen and U2 and Don Henley and Cyndi Lauper. I mean, there's so much music by so many, you know, gigantic legendary artists. Some were legends even at the time, but you know, in 2021, those people were legends. Tom Petty. I mean, so to sell 2 million copies, that's impressive.
Without a top 10 hit.
Right. Which is,
we never cracked the top 10,
which is mind boggling because, well, that's like Hey Jealousy by Gin Blossoms. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that was a number one song. That only went to number 25.
Wow.
I know. So it's really strange because I feel like with MTV, I feel like every time I saw Hooters on MTV, you just felt like those were, well, these are top 10 songs because I'm seeing them constantly in my living room.
They were on MTV.
They were on MTV. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Billboard wise, no.
Yep. Nope.
It's very, and was the label, I mean, you sold 2 million albums though. I mean, what does a top 10 hit equate to in album sales? Would you have sold, you know, 5 million if the songs were in the top 10, who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. I'm sure it would have made, I'm sure every number that you climb up that chart is an exponential growth in sales.
Right. But I'm sure appearing on Live Aid probably helped to sell some albums too.
Oh, it certainly did. And what I think it really helped with was our international, profile, because, you know, that was seen by a billion people around the world. And in Europe, it wasn't 9 o'clock in the morning. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Speaking of Europe, you really don't break there really until the One Way Home album comes out and Satellite goes to number 2 in Europe. Hush, little baby, don't cry.
Actually, Johnny B was what did it for us in Germany.
Okay.
Johnny B was, which was the first single in the US.
Yeah.
And a little bit of trivia, the video was directed by David Fincher.
It's a sleepless night. She's calling your name. It's a lonely ride. I know how you want her again and again. You're chasing a dream, yeah. But Johnny, my friend, she's not what she seems. Johnny B, how much there is to see. Just open your eyes and listen to me.
I was just going to ask, I mean, this is before, obviously before Fight Club and Social Network and Mank, which was just nominated for Academy Awards. What do you have any stories about working with David Fincher, or was he just another in a handful of directors?
He was a really good one in a handful of directors.
Well, yeah, sure.
I mean, he came into that. He had a really clear picture, a really clear story, mm-hmm. and he knew how he wanted to get it. And we were just actors.
So One Way Home comes out, mm-hmm. Rick Chertoff still producing. You guys are helping produce. Did you want to work with other producers, or was Rick your guy because he's been your champion all this time?
Well, at that point, yes, we definitely did. I mean, you know, not only our champion, but he really did bring out the best in us.
Yeah.
No, there was no question at that point. I mean, we hung with Rick through One Way Home, which got us to Germany and a bit into Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. And then Zigzag, which really cemented us in Scandinavia. You know, at the end of that, things just didn't feel good with the label.
Yeah.
Felt like we had sort of reached the end of whatever rope that was, and that it was time to do something different.
Well, after Nervous Night, they were probably hoping for bigger success from you guys.
Yeah, yeah. I think they were expecting Nervous Night 2.
Yeah. And One Way Home is not Nervous Night 2.
No,
I mean, there's three songs on there that are almost 6 minutes long. I mean, one is 6 minutes and the other two are very close. And that's not what Nervous Night was. Was that a conscious choice? Or do you guys just make music? This is the music we're making right now.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yep. I mean, there's always that, you know, that question, okay, what's the single?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we knew that Satellite was going to be a single. Mm-hmm. We knew that Johnny B was going to be a single. We thought that Carla with a K was sort of the slam dunk.
Yeah.
That, you know, that an edited version of that could do it, which was some very wishful thinking. But it's funny because, I mean, in some way, Carla with a K and All You Zombies are the signature songs of the Hooters.
Mm-hmm.
Like our fans, those are the songs that they go to, that they want to hear. In our live show, Carla is like probably the peak of the show.
Freedom has its ups and downs. You walk the streets of lonesome town. You try to find some company. Somebody who will talk to me. Well, I'm here all alone. With those hope, we'll find it someday. There's no reason to cry. For days gone by.
When Rob walks out with the accordion and I've got the mandolin, and even when we play at hard rock festivals in Germany and Scandinavia, the audience goes nuts when they see an accordion.
Let me ask you about this. The first two album covers, You and Rob and David seem to be featured a little bit more prominently on the, not seem to be, you are, you're yeah, more yeah. prominent. How does that make the other two guys feel? Like, are they like, what the fuck?
Yeah. You know, that question gets some mind share these days from me. Cause it's like, kind of, what were we thinking?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Rob and I, it was our band. We'd started the band.
Right.
It was David that made us a band. Until we had David, we were just two guys with a bunch of songs. All of a sudden with David, the three of us could play songs.
Gotcha.
And we just thought visually it kind of gave it a cool dimensionality thing to feature. I mean, we didn't see it in terms of those guys being excluded from the front cover. We
right,
saw it
I understand.
As those guys are featured on the back cover.
Yeah, I get it.
But again, it's kind of like, yeah, well, what were we thinking?
But at the time they didn't say anything. So
no,
because if they would have, maybe you would have said, oh, okay, I see where you're coming from, and maybe it would have been yep. different. But okay, yep. I was just curious because just looking at the album covers this week, I'm like, oh, this is interesting.
So yeah.
Zigzag, Brother, Don't You Walk Away. That's such a great song.
Brother, don't you walk away. Brother, don't you walk away. Tell me, why is it so hard to say it? Brother, don't you walk away.
Love it so much. For me, that should have been the first single, though. How hard is it yeah. picking singles? It must be so difficult, unless it really jumps out at everyone, like, this is it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there are albums where that's the case, where it's mm-hmm. really easy. Well, you know, obviously, Billie Jean is the first single. And there was a bit of debate actually on that. You know, I think I was advocating for Brother, Don't You Walk Away. 500 Miles was the first single, which was sort of the death knell in the United States.
Yeah.
But it got us Sweden. It got us Scandinavia and cemented our hold in Germany.
If you miss the train, I'm on. So blow 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles. You can hear the whistle blow 100 miles. Not a shirt on my back, not a penny to my name, and the land that I once loved. My own. Lord, I'm one. Lord, I'm two. Lord, I'm three. Lord, I'm four. Lord, I'm 500 miles away from home.
Yeah, that's a funny album. I have very mixed feelings about that album.
About Zigzag?
Yeah, yeah.
Give the Music Back starts with the melodica, which is a hooter.
Actually,
doesn't it?
No, I think that's a recorder.
It is. Well, I'm not a musician, Eric. I only know what I think I know. Well, let me ask you about this. When you name the band the Hooters, do you feel obligated to use the melodica on a couple of tracks all the time?
Not obligated, but motivated.
Motivated to. Okay.
It is. You know, it is a really great piece of our sonic palette. I even used it on my album.
Yes, you did.
But no, you know, it doesn't have to have a melodica to be Hooterized.
Okay.
A mandolin will Hooterize. A mandola will Hooterize. An accordion will Hooterize. Even an electric guitar played in the right way will Hooterize.
I do love them. I do love when you guys use the mandolin. I just, it's such a beautiful instrument and it always sounds good.
It does, boy. It just sits in there and says, "Hi, I'm a mandolin."
When you travel back and forth between Sweden and Philadelphia, how many guitars do you have in Sweden?
In Sweden, I have 3 electric guitars, an acoustic guitar, a bass, a mandolin, and a mandola.
And do you have the similar things in Philly or more stuff in Philly?
In Philly, I've got all of my vintage guitars. The guitars that I have here are all brand new guitars that were made by this guy in Finland. That's remarkable. I can live with just these guitars. Philadelphia, I've got my really sweet collection of vintage guitars. The Strat I played She's So Unusual on, the Gold Top Les Paul that I played One of Us on, the Les Paul Jr. that I played on every Hooters record.
Wow. So the Hooters have a song called Beat Up Guitar, and it sounds like you still have many beat up guitars.
I have many beat up. I actually don't have the beat up guitar that song is about. That was stolen in 1976, but I have it separated at birth twin, 1956 Les Paul Gold Top.
You lived on Vine Street, I lived at home. The music was all that we had of our own. No satisfaction, no gas in my car, but I had the keys to the world in my
Let me touch on some songs that you wrote for other people or with other people that I love so much. The 2 songs on the Patti Smyth album, Heartache Around the World and Never Enough. I love that record so much. That's just such a fun record. Again, that's kind of like your new album. That top to bottom for me always sounds good. I never tire of it. The songs on Hatful of Stars, the songs that you wrote with Cindy, are some of my favorites. Feels Like Christmas and Product of Misery. I mean, I don't know what it is about your songwriting, but when I see your name on a song, and you know, that comes from albums when you would look through the liner notes, but when I see your name, there were always artists or producers that if I saw their name, I immediately knew I was going to get something good. So you're one of the names that pops up.
Oh, cool.
Even on a song like the song To Be Alive Again, a Journey song. That is, and I think there's five songwriters on it, but you're one of them.
Yep.
And that's one of my favorites off the Arrival album.
Yep, that was came out of the blue. Jonathan Cain wanted to come write with me. And he had an idea for a song called Alive Again, which was the original title. And we wrote a version of it. And then he went off and did some more work on it. And suddenly it's on a Journey album.
How do I say this delicately? What song gives you the most mailbox money? What song did you write that you're always seeing returns from?
Oh, One of Us, of course.
It's One of Us for sure.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
And One of Us, because you wrote that on your own, sole writing credit on that.
Yep.
So that's probably one of the reasons why you're not splitting it with other people.
Right.
If God had a name, what would it be? And would you call it to his face? If you were faced with him in all his glory, what would you ask if you had just one question? God is great. God is good. What if God was one of us? Just a
when you write a song like that, is the band mad that you didn't bring that song to them?
Bear in mind, Rob was there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was there when I picked up his guitar and played the guitar riff for the first time. Then he was there the next day when I came in and played my demo of the song.
Okay.
He was there when Rick Chertoff said, "Joan, do you think you could sing that?" And he was the one that pressed record when we recorded the first demo of her singing it with my guitar. So at any time he could have said, "Hey, that we should keep that for the Hooters."
Okay.
But it never occurred to him, and it never occurred to me, because once we heard Joan's voice on that song, that was it. You know, you could say the same thing about Time After Time. Should we have kept that for the Hooters? No, we should not have kept that for the Hooters.
Right, right. No, Cindy's version is amazing. Ridiculous. But again, here we go. It's almost like a She's So Unusual situation. You're on ground zero here with Joan Osborne.
Yep.
That here, I didn't even realize this till now. That's my wife's favorite album, Relish. Oh, cool. And I had a coaster made.
Oh, wow.
Of the album cover for her, this, I don't know, for Chris, for something, but it sits here on our desk. But nice. Yeah. So yeah, that again, what songs did you co-write on Relish?
Most of it.
Yeah. Right Hand Man. What a killer track, Dracula Moon, St. Teresa. I mean, and again, one of us, that's Joan's signature song.
Yep.
Again, she can't play a concert and not do that song. That's probably your biggest success as a songwriter and everything, right? Charts.
As a musician.
Yeah.
That one checks all the boxes, except for my not being the lead singer on it.
Right, exactly.
I'm fine with that.
I'm fine with that. And did Joan immediately like the song? It wasn't a girls just want to have fun situation.
I don't, to this day, I'm not really sure how Joan feels about the song. You know, when I played the demo it was Rob and Rick and Joan and I in the room. We were writing songs for that album at the time. And when I played my demo, I had no expectation. It hadn't occurred to me that it would be something for Joan. Mm-hmm. And Rick Chertoff blindsided us by asking her, do you think you could sing that? He didn't ask, would you like to sing that? He didn't ask, would that be a good song for the album? Uh-huh. Because she probably, I don't know what she would have said, but I don't think one of them would have been, yeah, let's do this. Let's make this my signature song.
Yeah.
But she said, yeah, I can sing it. And I wrote out the lyrics and ran her through the melodies. And we all listened back and it was just like, you know, game over.
Yeah, goosebumps.
Yeah. It was the same feeling I had the first time Rob and Cindy played me their first sketch of Time After Time. I just knew we're going to be hearing this song for a long time.
And we still are. 2008, you guys hook up with Joan again for the Little Wild One album. Were you trying to recapture that magic, or did she reach out to you? How did that work, that project?
Do you remember the film Standing in the Shadows of Motown?
I don't know that I have seen that. No.
Great, great film. It's about the Funk Brothers, the, you know, the band.
Yeah.
For all the Motown records. And there were a number of guest vocalists, and one of them was Joan singing What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. And while I was in the movie theater, I called her and I whispered, why aren't we still making music together?
Yeah.
Because it was her decision not to do the second album with us. I think she felt that after Rick and Rob and I had such a strong footprint.
Yeah.
On that first album, she wanted to do something on her own, which, you know, career-wise, well, I don't know, but it's what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
So 2001, I'm like, this is crazy. So she started coming down And she and I started working, and then she and Rob and I started working. And then we just thought, you know what, let's do the whole thing. Let's get Rick back into the mix. So we actually recorded that album in 2003 and four.
Wow, but it didn't come out till 2008.
Yep.
Flood tide below me with the sun in my eyes, and I reach for the feeling that the world is my prize. I am crossing Brooklyn Ferry with the clouds to my west, and I know what I'm missing. Some are sweet, but you were sweeter.
And you co-wrote seven songs, I think, on that album.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we, you know, I think we went into it hoping that we'd get lucky and one of us, pun not intended, would write the hit.
Right. And, but again, the musical landscape, by the time that's released in 2008, it's so different from, you know, 1995. You know,
yep.
Just all the reasons we talked about earlier, how you find music, how you purchase it, how people play it. And can you get airplay, you know, this many years afterwards? It's yeah, it's difficult, but it's a great record. I think you guys nailed it. And that's one of my favorites of hers. And again, yep. When I saw you guys were all back together, because again, I'm an album credit person, or, you know, I read an article that you guys were all working together, releasing something. I got excited as you do when you're a music fan, but I want to talk about one more time. I want to talk about the album Bazillion, which will be out in a couple of weeks. You can find it digitally and then down the line, physical copies.
Yep.
And then I guess you can't even think about making it when you have a new project. Are you still thinking about new songs? Are you a guy that's always writing?
Yeah. To greater or lesser degrees. Yeah, I am. I'm always in a better headspace when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. Writing is really therapy for me. So I'm always trying, you know, it's been a while now. Honestly, I've been kind of busy.
Yeah.
But now that I'm back here for a while, I haven't gone back to the basement yet since we got back yesterday, but I'm heading there after dinner.
All right. And what's it seems very relaxed in Sweden. Is it very, what's it like there as opposed to being in the States?
It's very similar. I think it culturally okay. It might be the closest to the US of all the European countries.
Oh, okay.
I've been to, people are nice. People are polite.
Nice. That's a plus.
Yep. You don't see a lot of masks out on the street.
Are you wearing a mask in Sweden?
I don't. I'm fully vaccinated, and no one else is wearing them. I do. If I go on public transportation, which is the one place now where the government has recommended that people wear masks.
Okay.
And I'd say about 50% of them are taking that advice.
Okay.
But sort of a courtesy thing I do. You know, but we're just in the U.S. and masks everywhere all the time.
Yeah, I'm fully vaxxed also. But if I go in public, I'm wearing a mask.
Yep.
I didn't get a cold this year. I didn't get a cold.
Yep, that's right.
I usually get a cold every year, maybe two.
So maybe the Asians really did have something going all along.
I know. And we would, a couple of years ago, you'd give them the side eye like, come on, do you really need to wear that? But.
Yep.
So we're learning things in COVID also.
Yep.
Okay. So again, 2021, Bazillion, 10 tracks, 35 minutes, solid top to bottom. If you were to choose one song on the album for me to use as my playout song today, what song would you choose?
The High Note.
The High Note.
Yep. Because you want to go out on a high note.
Perfect. Thank you, Eric. And let me tell everyone where they can find you on the internet. You can go to ericbazilian.com. Twitter, it's at Eric Bazilian. And Instagram, I think, is also at Eric Bazilian. Are you a social media guy or only when you have a project to promote?
You know, I try to keep a presence there. You know, there's also a Facebook, Eric Bazilian Music.
There you go.
Oh, this is a cool wall. Or, yeah, look where I am now. I'm right on the coast of Maine. Guess where I am?
Right.
I mean, I probably should be a lot more than I am. And I go through phases with it.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's like my head is taken up with way more important things in social media.
Yeah. But it is the way to promote and get the word out on the new album and things like
this. It is now, you know, as long as live shows aren't a thing, this is it.
And when do you think, or when do you anticipate that you will be on stage again?
Well, as it stands now, the Hooters have a show in Quakertown, PA on August 13th.
Okay.
And then another show the 14th. We have shows booked going into the fall. So hopefully that will all happen.
Okay, so fingers crossed that these happen. They're on the books, but you never know. But hopefully you guys will be out there and playing. And then what about an Eric Bazilian solo show? Because you're not going to mix these songs into a Hooters set.
Probably not. We have done that in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll see. If one of the songs becomes a smash virally.
Well, then it's
I could totally see the band doing Back in the 80s.
True. That would make sense.
You know, so as far as solo shows go, yeah, look, as soon as they're booking shows again, I'm in.
You're in. You're all in.
I'm all in. You know, I was really hoping to, you know, when we found out that our 2020-21 tour had been postponed again till 22, I started thinking, wow, maybe I can get some solo shows booked for the summer.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, shows just aren't really a thing.
They're not a thing.
And if I'm going to go out and play live, I have two kinds of shows. I do shows where I have a band and I rehearse the band. Mm-hmm. And then I have shows where I just go out by myself and it's half storyteller and half music.
And those are great. I love those types of shows.
Those are a blast. I love doing those. So, you know, maybe some of those will pop up this summer.
And what about an online virtual show where you do just that? Play a handful of songs and tell a handful of stories.
You know, I did a couple of live streams in the beginning of COVID. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I guess I can give it another shot. And the other thing is I don't want to just sit and play them on a guitar.
Gotcha.
And I don't want to do them to backing tracks. And I did that on one of the live streams. Okay. And it was okay. Everybody liked it. But if I'm going to do a live stream, I want to do it with a band in a place where the band can be together with people who are comfortable being together in a room.
Because you need some immediate feedback. That's where the adrenaline and that's where the juice comes from.
Yeah. Now I've seen people who, you know, do live streams where they'll have the camera set up in front of them and they'll have a big screen with, you know, 50 of their fans' faces popping up on there. And that's cool. But I don't really have that ecosystem in my fan base.
Gotcha. Well, look, thanks again for giving me this time. Everybody go buy Bazilian when it's available. You can follow us at Rock Solid Show on Twitter and go to rocksolidpodcast.com for all things about the show. Again, thank you, Eric. And everyone, please enjoy The High Note.
Love we're bringing, trying to hit the high note. song.